Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Robert Borges, registration number 19577, appearing on behalf of the defendant appellant, Philip Board, who is appealing the denial of his motion for post-conviction relief without an evidentiary hearing. And the issue in this case boils down to the question of whether the district court erred in denying the motion without conducting an evidentiary hearing, where the above adequate factual allegations set forth in the motion, and where the court effectively made findings that there was no prejudice demonstrated. And although we've raised two issues in our opening brief, I want to focus this afternoon on the first issue, that being trial counsel's ineffective assistance in failing to secure the attendance of Latera Bell, who's a material witness in this case. And I would defer to what is in our opening brief and in our reply brief and people's answer brief on the second issue. And since Judge Madden denied Mr. Board's claim on the first issue on the prejudice prong of Strickland, I want to start by talking about how Mr. Board was prejudiced by the court's ruling in this case. Basically, Your Honors, Mr. Board was charged and convicted of felony murder and attempted aggravated robbery. And there were two pieces of evidence that were introduced at trial to support an aggravated robbery or an attempted aggravated robbery. The first was the testimony of the co-defendant. And as spelled out throughout our brief and in the record, the co-defendant had some credibility issues. In addition, the co-defendant was the beneficiary of what we believe to be a rather generous plea disposition people offered. I think he got 4 years in exchange for pleading guilty and cooperating in prosecution of Mr. Board. The other piece of evidence that the jury heard to support the finding that there was an attempted aggravated robbery was the testimony of Detective Martinez. And Detective Martinez, this is the double hearsay and one admission, you know, chain link of statements that the detective testified, Ms. Bell testified, Ms. Brasser testified, that Mr. Board reportedly said that he was out looking to commit a robbery. And it's our position that but for trial counsel's ineffective assistance in failing to secure the attendance of that witness, that never would have come in at trial. And the judge found that there was no prejudice that could be demonstrated in this case by adopting the people's argument that this would have come in anyway, even without the unavailability of Ms. Bell. And there are a couple of significant problems with that theory. The first being that the people never would have known when they presented their case in chief who the defense was going to be calling in their case, because the defendant is never obligated to call any witnesses in his defense.
And but if the defense, the prosecution had listed Ms. Bell as a witness, correct?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. If the defense had her under subpoena, couldn't the prosecution have called Ms. Bell in the prosecution's case?
Conceivably, yes. Okay. All right. At some point in time, either in the prosecution's case or in the defense case by cross-examination, the prosecutor would have been eventually able to question Ms. Bell. Okay? And that gets into my second problem with the people's theory of how this would have evolved. And that is, even if everything fell into place the way the people hypothesized that it would happen, this would not have happened as smoothly and neatly as they believe it would have happened. Because what would have occurred is Ms. Brasser would have testified in the people's case in chief. Okay? And we know what she said because she actually did testify in the people's case in chief. And by the way, there's nothing to indicate that she would have ever said that Mr. Board said that he was trying to commit a robbery. Because if you look, and I believe we attached this, it's in the record, we attached it to our motion or our reply in support of our motion, the excerpts from Ms. Brasser's recorded interview by the police 2 days after, or a day after the shooting happened, you'll see that she never mentions anything about Mr. Board mentioning a robbery. So, while anything is possible, I think we would be looking at Ms. Brasser testifying the same way she did actually testify at trial.
Well, that assumes the prosecutor doesn't ask her about the statement that Ms. Bell attributes to her.
Correct.
Okay, wasn't one of the prosecutors present when Ms. Bell was interviewed by the police, and so the prosecution would have had actual knowledge of what they could get out of Ms. Bell?
There was a prosecutor present, and there was also the district attorney's investigator who was present. And that's kind of interesting, too, because that took place, I believe, as August 12th, 2004, was that interview. And there's nothing in the discovery to indicate that she said that, Ms. Bell said that at that time. There's nothing to indicate that there was anything inconsistent with that written statement that I believe we attached to our either motion or our reply brief in the trial court. And I think Judge Madden also made reference to it in a footnote in his written order, that there's nothing in Ms. Bell's statement to indicate that she ever heard Ms. Brasser say that Mr. Boyd reported that he was trying to commit a robbery. And
are you suggesting that Detective Martinez made that up?
I don't know where he got that from, Your Honor, because in the discovery, there's nothing about that. And also, the district attorney's investigator, Dan Giles, testified at trial, and he was at the August 12, 2004 interview. He never mentions that either. So,
what was he asked?
I don't remember him being asked. I don't remember. You would think that would be something significant that the prosecution would want to bring out.
Well, only if Ms. Bell was there. I mean, they couldn't ask the investigator what Ms. Bell said, because that would be hearsay.
Correct.
Unless Ms. Bell had previously testified and denied it, then you could get it in under 1610-201.
Correct, but I would also mention, Your Honor, that I don't believe that was referenced in the people's response to the 35C motion. In other words, the people had an opportunity to include an affidavit from Mr. Giles in their response to our 35C motion, mm-hmm. saying, yeah, this is what happened at the August 12, 2004, and there's nothing like that in the record. So,
okay.
But getting back to what we've got here, we would have had Ms. Brasser testify, and presumably she would have said what she said. We would have had Ms. Bell testify, and again, since we didn't actually have a 35C hearing, we don't know exactly what she would have said, but we do have her written statement, and that's in the record, and there's no mention of a robbery there. So at that point, perhaps the people would have tried to bring the detective in as rebuttal, had Ms. Bell testified as she did in that written statement. Okay? At that point, the people may have brought the detective in, but he would have been subjected to cross-examination about the fact that this appears nowhere in these other witnesses' statements, the fact that this comes up at this August 2004 interview, and it's not in the record anywhere in discovery.
Couldn't all those points have been brought out if the defense had chosen to, when Detective Martinez testified under the CRA 807 agreement?
Well, and you know, in preparing for today, I went back and looked at the transcripts on that, and my recollection was that the public defender called the detective in, put him on, conducted direct examination. The prosecutor then did cross-examination, brought out the other stuff, the stuff that we're here for today, and then there was no redirect. All right, so to answer your question, it wasn't done, and that too might have come up at the 35C hearing.
But it could.
As part of the ineffective assistance, because he might have been able to do damage control at that point.
But that allegation was not in the motion.
No, it wasn't. But.
And that wasn't the basis for your ineffective assistance claim, is what I'm saying.
That wasn't the primary basis, that's correct.
It wasn't any basis, part of
well, it wasn't pleaded.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. So basically what we have here are two pieces of evidence that the jury heard that there was an attempted robbery, all right? There's the co-defendant's testimony and there's the detective's testimony. Which of those two is going to carry more weight in the eyes of the jury? A law enforcement officer on the one hand, or a co-defendant who was charged in this case originally, was the beneficiary of a rather generous plea disposition and had inconsistencies in his testimony? This is prejudicial, Your Honor, and I think that had Judge Madden afforded us an evidentiary hearing, there would have been a better record on this today.
Well, it's prejudicial only if you assume that the prosecution couldn't have gotten it in had defense counsel had Ms. Bell under subpoena. That's the prejudice, isn't it?
Well, the prejudice, Your Honor, is even if the prosecution got to bring this up in rebuttal, had Ms. Bell testified,
How is that materially different from what happened here?
It's very materially different because there's a number of different links along the way. And we've got the investigator, the detective's testimony that was shaky. If you look at his testimony during examination, direct examination, I think we mentioned this in our brief, at one point, when he was first asked if Mr. or J.D. had said that somebody was shooting at him, he initially said Mr. Board said that. It was only when the public defender showed him, brought to his attention that that was incorrect, that he corrected himself. His testimony was not rock solid, Your Honor. And in this case, in Artolino, there was discussion about how where the case was not a case of overwhelming evidence of guilt, it was shaky enough that it could have made a difference, but for trial counsel's ineffective assistance. We have an analogous situation here where this evidence was not rock solid of an aggravated robbery, or an attempted aggravated robbery, right? So that's the point I'm trying to make. And I think that when you take this out of the equation, it gets even wobblier, more wobbly. So unless there are any other questions, I have 3 minutes and 45 seconds. I reserve that for rebuttal.
They're all yours.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of people, bar number 38141. Two basic considerations control this case. One, even absent defense counsel's alleged deficient performance, the statement still would have come in. And two, even assuming that the statement should not have come in, the result at the trial would not have been different. Like this court's cases have recognized, Krimke 35C plainly provides that in deciding whether a defendant should be given a hearing, the trial court first must consider whether the defendant presented adequate factual legal grounds, whether the defendant presented sufficient grounds, whether if true would entitle the defendant to relief, and even assuming those two tests are met, whether the record refutes those claims and therefore the defendant is not entitled to a hearing because the record does not support his factual contentions. Under those three express and limited standards, the trial court correctly denied the defendant's post-conviction claims. The first claim, I'm going to focus on the first claim, that's all defense counsel presented today. Three independent justifications support the trial court's ruling. One, the defendant's claims were speculative and conclusory. Two, the defendant's claims, even if true, under the existing record, did not establish a basis for relief. And three, given the record that we have, even assuming things would have happened as the defendant says they should have happened, the result of trial would not have been different given the limited probative value of the statement he now challenges should not have been admitted. With respect to the first, as this court held in Osorio, a trial court correctly denies a post-conviction motion when the defendant's claim requires a reviewing court to speculate as to whether the defendant was prejudiced. That is exactly what happened in this case. The defendant's claim rested on several levels of speculation. It required the trial court to find that had defense counsel acted as defense counsel acted, he should have, that several different layers, several different things would have happened, precluding the statement from being admitted.
Counsel, for the appellant, has made the argument in the briefs that it's actually the trial court that was doing the speculating as to how those evidence might have come in anyway regarding the robbery. What's your comment as to that?
I would disagree as to the framing, because under the rule, a defendant bears the initial burden of presenting adequate facts, which we assume is true, that actually set forth the claim that if they were true, the defendant would be entitled to relief. The problem we have in this case is, under the defendant's facts, it presented an incomplete statement of facts that would entitle him to the relief and the prejudice that he claimed. And I think a good example of that is if we compare what the defendant presented in his brief below versus how he's arguing on appeal. I think that shows us quite much of what he needs to know. In his original post-conviction claim, the defendant argued the statement, he was prejudiced because the statement should not have come in and had his attorney not agreed with that stipulation, that the people would not have been able to admit it as a prior consistent statement. On appeal and saying oral argument, he presented additional reasons explaining why, assuming that's true, the statement still would not have come in because, under his view, the people would have been unaware of the statements. So the problem with the original claim was it was still missing a piece. Even accepting of what he said is true, it still did not set forth facts that would have established that the statement would not have come in.
But Mr. Lee, maybe I misunderstand what the defendant is saying, but I thought he was in his motion and on appeal saying, we know that as what actually happened in this case was this problematic hearsay statement was admitted because of the deal struck by the defense counsel. That's why it came in, actually. And the trial court's decision that it would have come in anyway in a different scenario, that's where the speculation comes in. Because that's assuming if certain things had happened, the prosecutor would have made certain decisions and then found a way to admit the evidence anyway. But that's the speculation. In fact, we know why it was admitted here. It was because of defense counsel's particular agreement. So I don't understand why you think the defense counsel's argument is based on speculation, when it seems like the trial court's entire analysis is wondering what the prosecutor would have done if the facts had been different.
Sure. I think what the trial court's analysis is doing is explaining what the defendant could have alleged and why his claim was speculative. So what we have here is, and it's unique from most ineffective assistance of counsel claims, in the way it's not saying my counsel should have presented this, and then we know what would have been presented, and then that presents a complete claim of prejudice for a court to review. It's if we take away a fact which changed other facts at trial, then I was prejudiced because of that. And then the missing piece in that argument, as was presented below, is he never accounted for that, how that would have changed other things at trial. Because again, we know that the prosecution admitted the evidence the way it did because it had a stipulation.
I thought the defense admitted, the prosecution admitted it on cross-examination of Detective Martinez in the defense case.
Yes, sure. So the prosecutor did admit it, and again, he admitted it after the stipulation had already been reached. So it wasn't enough for defense counsel just to say, well, if we change part of the record and say that the stipulation was never reached, the evidence would have never come in. And I think as the trial court's order then makes clear, as we already in our brief, it's missing several levels of facts that's necessary to make it non-speculation, because they need to account for the changed record for which their own post-conviction claim rests upon.
I'm sorry. Go a little slower. I don't understand what you mean when you say, you know, it doesn't account for the changed record.
Okay, so the defendant bears the burden to present facts, if true. If we just assume, and that's the point of having a hearing, is if the defendant can prove everything he says he's going to prove, would he win? And the problem with this case is the allegations did not do that. The defendant said, had my attorney not reached the stipulation, the people could not admit the evidence the way that they did.
Okay, why isn't that a sufficiently reasonable inference to justify a hearing, given the fact that Ms. Brasser's video statement or transcription of her tape-recorded statement didn't refer to this statement by J.D., and Ms. Bell's written statement or recorded statement didn't refer to Ms. Brasser's statement? Why doesn't that create a reasonable likelihood that this never would have come in?
Okay, I think there's two separate issues that are being conflated in that hypothetical. One is whether the prosecutor knew about the statement, which I think is clear on the record, because the prosecutor admitted the evidence, and there's never any discussion except for the fact the prosecutor did admit the evidence. And there's the question of whether or not the prosecutor would have tried to not admit it, which I think is the real claim of prejudice, especially presented in the post-conviction motion. So then the question is, why is the defendant's claim insufficient to establish, as originally alleged, that the evidence would not have come in? So the defendant's allegation in the post-conviction motion only claimed that the evidence would not have come in had the attorney not reached a stipulation. And he only argued that because of that stipulation, that's why the evidence came in. He did not account for the real possibility, which the record tells us, that the evidence would have come in through other ways.
Okay, but how can we draw that conclusion without the benefit of a hearing, since we're essentially hypothesizing, I suppose, what a reasonable prosecutor might have asked a witness who in fact wasn't there if the witness had been there under some additional scenario. I mean, suppose at a hearing, the prosecutor gets asked, would you have brought this up had Ms. Bell been under subpoena? And the prosecutor says, no, I didn't think it was important. Or the prosecutor says, now, I may have been at that interview, but I had no memory of it. That was the furthest thing from my mind when we were going to try this case. Isn't that what aren't those nuances precisely what a hearing is for?
Okay, two responses. First, that's not what the defense argued in his post-conviction motion. The problem is he did not say that the evidence would not have come in. He specified to the evidence would not have come in as a prior inconsistent statement, given that an attorney never would have reached that stipulation. That doesn't account for the possibility that it could have come in through other ways.
Yeah,
the defendant alleged that the statement could not.
That's my point. How do you know it would have come in in other ways without giving the benefit, the defendant the benefit of an opportunity to interrogate the prosecutors to find out, you know, what they knew, what they remembered, and what they would have done. I'm not saying that the hearing would turn out well for the defendant. We don't know. I'm saying, how can you assume that?
Well, here we have the people's response. So again, the whole point of having a hearing is what, one way to look at how, whether to have a hearing is what would have been said. And again, we have the prosecutor's response in this case that he would have presented it. That's in the record, and that's what the trial court relied on. So we do know, to answer your question directly, that the prosecutor, what the prosecutor would have said in the hearing.
Is it under oath?
It's not. But the prosecutor is an officer of the court.
But he's not subject to cross-examination.
Nor is his credibility subject to findings.
Yes. I would agree with that. But just to answer your direct question of how, whether, do we know what the prosecutor is going to say, it's likely we know what the prosecutor would say, because that is in the record, the prosecutor's response. And I think there's nothing in the basis to say that the prosecutor was lying.
Well, I wouldn't imply that, but the quality of the prosecutor's recollection could be tested by cross-examination, and then the judge would decide which was the more plausible scenario. Isn't that why we have hearings?
It is why we have hearings, but I guess in this case, another reason why, even assuming that issue, the defendant would not be entitled to a hearing, because based on the record, we know that the statement was not material.
So tell me why not.
The claim of prejudice on appeal is that had the statement essentially corroborated the co-defendant's account that the defendant committed a robbery when he was shooting the victim. That evidence was cumulative, of course, to the co-defendant's own testimony that the defendant said that before he shot the victim. So the issue in this case is whether or not that evidence not coming in or coming in did a better job of corroborating the co-defendant's account. And in this case, other evidence did corroborate the co-defendant's account. The defendant's girlfriend said, she testified that the defendant told her that he shot the victim.
But what does that have to do with the robbery? I thought that was the key here, whether the underlying felony was an attempted robbery. And I thought no other witness besides, only JD testified about defendant's intent to commit a robbery other than this hearsay statement. So was there some other evidence that it was a robbery?
There was not, Your Honor. I'm asking the issue with trial.
Wasn't that important? You say that's not, but that's the key, at least according to the defendant's motion.
I'm saying the key is whether or not the co-defendant was credible. And I'm saying there's other evidence corroborating directly, and there's other evidence corroborating the accuracy of his account. And I'm saying adding additional facts. So he said two things in the story. The defendant said he shot someone and he did it, and right before the shooting he said he was going to rob it.
Okay, now that's what JD testified.
Yes. And then
then you say there's other evidence corroborating the, not the shooting, put that aside. Because in closing argument, his attorney basically begged for a guilty verdict for reckless manslaughter. Okay, so other than JD's statement, what corroborates defendant's intent to have committed a robbery?
There wasn't any error. What I'm pointing to is just the fact that I think the issue was whether or not the co-defendant was telling the truth. So it's whether his story, and I think there's nothing separating the credibility of his account of the shooting from the robbery. Either
well,
you believe
I'm concerned by your statement earlier that this hearsay statement that we're talking about, which does implicate the defendant in a robbery, you said earlier that was not material. Isn't that, I don't see how you can maintain that position that's not material if that's the only other evidence confirming or corroborating JD's testimony about the robbery.
Because I just think the issue, again, was whether or not JD was telling the truth. And whether or not a witness corroborated him on one point or two points, it's still whether or not the jury would have believed his account. Because there's nothing separating his story to make his account about the shooting or the robbery more credible than the other.
How about the fact that he was facing a murder one charge and plea bargained it down to 4 years? Doesn't that cloud his credibility?
That clouds his credibility as a whole, but I think the question is whether or not we can parse out his credibility to the shooting apart from the robbery. So the question was, it really was the issue for the jury, was whether you can believe him at all or not believe him at all. And the evidence in the jury made that determination. And I'm saying
can believe him about some issues and disbelieve him about others. That's up to the jury. We don't have to assume that the jury is going to believe this testimony in one block or reject it in one block.
It is, Your Honor, but I'm saying in this count, at least the way I read the record, there's no way to distinguish, to parse out why they would believe one part of the statement but not the other. His account was his account for those two things. There's nothing making one his comment about the shooting any more credible than his comment about the robbery. And to the extent that there's anything corroborating his testimony, the defendant's girlfriend did testify that his account was correct. So given that, I would argue that it was not material. And the fact that if memory serves, it was not actually even cited to by the people, because I argue the statement introduced to Martinez as defense now challenging. But to return to the original issue on the speculation, what the trial court found, and I think it's correct, is that the defendant needed to state enough facts, if true, before we get to these questions of credibility. He needs to say that he needs to set forth enough facts that actually then turned it. So I think on appeal, the defendants presented arguments that were not presented in his motion, his original post-conviction motion, that actually would have made the claim public. Okay.
Didn't the trial court make a specific finding bolstered by a fairly thoughtful evidentiary analysis of how the evidence would have come in if Ms. Bell had been under subpoena?
Yes. But I think all that shows, again, and I think that is why the defense made his arguments on appeal the way he has, is that just shows what would have made the defendant's original claim a colorable claim, one actually meriting a hearing. Had the defendant argued that the evidence would not have come in, and actually presented enough facts establishing, as some of the things today have discussed have, that it would have actually made it probable that the people would not have admitted the evidence, then he might have been entitled to a hearing.
Didn't his filings in the lower court include the statements of Brasser and Bell so that the reader could see that there was no reference to this hearsay that eventually came in?
Under the rule, the defendant has to make the allegations.
Well, on that point, didn't he allege, or didn't his post-conviction expert allege, that this evidence would not have been admissible through Martinez if Bell had been present to testify?
Yes.
That was his allegation. You're saying you can't infer from that allegation that he's saying the evidence was not admissible?
I'm saying that's the closest we get, and that was
conclusory. Isn't that pretty darn close?
It's conclusory. It provides no basis for the court to find.
If true, it would give him a basis for relief. That would also allege the facts to be true for purposes of deciding whether he's a hearing.
Had it
so, if we assume that's true, then he gets a hearing on that question, doesn't he?
I would argue that if I can continue, that one claim was conclusory, and that actually, although it was included in Brasser's effort of what would be presented, that is contrary to what was actually alleged in the motion. And that although, if true, it would prove it, again, we have a separate bar, but this conclusory and the defendant, even in that statement, did not set sufficient grounds in order for the court to find that would be true.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honors, some good questions that came out during the prosecution's argument. But I think that, and I think we make this clear in our brief, that the post-conviction court had to do some speculating as to what would have happened had this case been tried the way the prosecution, after the fact, said they would have tried it. There's a lot of stuff that would have been developed at a 35C hearing. I think the court hit the nail on the head by mentioning that there was the meeting in August of 2004, which the prosecutor and her investigator and the detective were all present and interviewed this woman. And there are questions as to, this was a significant statement by Ms. Bell that the detective testified was made. One would think it would have been reduced to writing and disclosed in discovery. That's the kind of stuff that would be brought out at a 35C hearing. And regarding whether this was material or not, my client was convicted of first-degree murder. And as the court correctly pointed out, during closing argument, trial counsel did plead with the jury to come back with reckless manslaughter as a conviction and ask for the lesser non-included offense instruction and verdict option. And that's the difference here. That's the difference, because without the attempted aggravated robbery, there's no felony murder. There might be reckless manslaughter. That's a big difference. Unless there are any questions by the panel, we would ask that the court reverse the denial of the 35C motion and remand this for an appropriate evidentiary hearing.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. In due course, we will issue a written opinion.